Welcome into the KSRO Kitchen. I'm Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash. And today we welcome Paul Friedman from the East Coast. It's just an amorphous, the East Coast, who's just written a book called 10 Restaurants That Changed America. That's a pretty big claim. And I know several interviewers and reviewers have taken you to task for how you came up with these 10. But I thought it was, I couldn't think of a better 10. So quite a magnificent effort. Thanks for coming in today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I will read that you are a history professor at Yale University, the editor of the IACP award-winning Food, the History of Taste, and the author of Out of the East, Spices in the Medieval Imagination. You live in New York, and do you teach history at Yale at this point?
I do. My day job, my main responsibility, is teaching medieval history, and I also am able to teach a course on the history of food.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I guess some part of it is that my interest in food kind of got out of hand. My hobby morphed into something larger.
Was it the eating part of it, or just food in general?
I would say I was always interested in food, but not extraordinary in an extraordinary way. I think it was seeing a group of menus at an exhibit in the New York Public Library around 2003 that first made me think about modern food and how unusual American food was in the past and how different it was from what we eat now, and made me want to just find out what happened, what changed.
It was interesting. You included in here lots of illustrations of old menu covers and old menus and all of that. And we lived a different time back 100 years ago or 125 years ago. I mean, it was very elegant.
They were elegant, and they communicated a kind of fantasy. So even a restaurant that didn't have very authentic Polynesian food would have a wonderful cover design, and tiki restaurants and places like that. Restaurants in the imagination, what Americans thought a German restaurant would look like, or Chinese restaurant menus with a faux oriental look. I was fascinated by that.
So the research began several years ago?
Yes, about took me maybe 5 years to write this book. And I have to say, not that it was easy, but that compared to medieval history, where your material is on parchment that's 800 years old, it's not published, it's in some weird archive, this was not, and it's not in English either, of course. This was pretty easy by comparison.
So how did, you know, this is the probably the silly question, how did you choose these 10 restaurants?
Well, my overriding principle was influential restaurants, not the best restaurants. So they're not necessarily the restaurants that offered the best food ever in America, although some of them, like Chez Panisse or Le Pavillon, certainly did. Others, like Howard Johnson, is important because you can't have modern fast food or fast casual or roadside food or franchised food without the pioneering steps that Howard Johnson innovated. In other cases, it's types of food. You can't imagine American food without the African-American influence, is too weak a word, the African-American creation of a lot of American food. You can't imagine American restaurants without Chinese restaurants. There are now 40,000 of them. Same with Italian restaurants. So part of it was typology, so-called ethnic foods. Some of it was modern food, the way we have organized dining out, Howard Johnson's, for example. And some of it was quality, things that were imitated, and regional food.
So it begs the question, is there an American cuisine, do you think? Or is it just an amalgamation of all of these?
I'd say it's an amalgamation more than a single cuisine, but there are certain kinds of guiding ideas. I would say one of them is variety. American cuisine and American diners value variety. That can be in the sense of so-called ethnic restaurants. So people will say things like, well, I don't want to have a Thai meal tonight because I had one. I had a Thai lunch yesterday. And that's a little odder than it seems, even though you hear that every day. Mm. Not only in Thailand wouldn't they say that, but in most parts of the world today, still, there's a certain cuisine, and that's what you eat 99 times out of 100. There's just a limited repertoire, but with a lot of depth. We tend to go for shallow, but a lot of variety. That, I would say, is the basic principle.
Well, in the book, you do call out those classic kind of American cuisine things that have remained around, like the cooking of New Orleans, or maybe even the cooking of the Northeast or the Southwest or places like that, which have remained. But are we losing them?
I think we're actually regaining them a little bit, in the South particularly, or reinventing them, as with California. I believe there really is such a thing as California cuisine, but it's not like it is the revival of what people ate in the 1880s or the Gold Rush era. It is a new creation. The fact that it's based on local ingredients makes it legitimate to call it California cuisine. In the case of Louisiana, that's the most intact old cuisine that has survived, even flourished in certain respects, into our time. And that's why I chose Antoine's as one of my restaurants. It's not so much that it influenced America in every respect, but it represents the preservation of something that answers your earlier question about what is cuisine in America.
Mm. There was in the very beginning of the book, there was a little, I wrote it down because I thought, this is an interesting kind of comment. It was that Europe lives on a tradition, America lives on variety when you talk about food. And I think this is what you were saying earlier about that we just, in a sense, were spoiled.
or we want to experiment with things. Some of this is the result of corporate control of food being more extensive in America. So if you want to have yogurt, until recently, you had to have yogurt that was basically made in a factory and far away. And how good could that yogurt be? Because they needed a kind of technology that deprives it of flavor compared to something made locally or homemade or in a very small amount. The exchange was the yogurt came in 50 flavors. None of them all that great, but at least you didn't have to have blueberry every day. You could change it around. And that's been the compensating factor for our essentially industrialized food. So what's happened recently, the focus on actual quality, that is something new in my opinion.
So you'd also written that the providing options is a way of diverting the subject away from the quality of the product, to speak to that.
That's right. So we will have, say, orange juice. You know, it's an industrial product. It's transported in trucks. But you can get it in some pulp, no pulp, calcium added, Grove Stand, whatever the categories are, that's to get you interested, maintain your interest, experiment, and forget about the fact that it's fine, but it's not a very high quality product. Whereas in Europe, if you take the case of tortellini, for example, when I was in Bologna once, I was taken out to a restaurant, and a specialty of Bologna, one of them is tortellini. And they were the best tortellini I ever had in my life, I must say. And my host said, you know, in other towns in Italy, they make tortellini with spinach and with cheese. And I stupidly said, oh, do you ever do that here? And he looked at me like I was crazy. He said, Bologna? It's meat in Bologna. I mean, he didn't say stupid, but and they're not going to experiment. They're not going to wake up one day and say, you know, why don't we do like they do in Rimini and make some cheese tortellini today? That's not American. Mm. You know, we have pumpkin squash tortellini. Who knows what kinds of flavors, because we like to experiment.
We should jump in because we have 10 restaurants to touch on before the hour.
You know, one quick thing, because we are going to touch on all these restaurants, but I thought it was fascinating that one of the comments you made early on in the book was that we only had restaurants in America since the 1830s, that restaurants were not, I mean, we take them for, actually, I guess we eat more of our food in restaurants now than we eat at home, but the restaurants were a rare commodity.
They were actually invented in Paris not long before the French Revolution. And by restaurant, we don't mean just dining out, because of course people have dined out forever. But dining out in a place where you have some choice, as opposed to a tavern where you have things like snacks to accompany drinks, or a boarding house where you basically are served a set meal at a set time. At a restaurant, you have a choice of time, a choice of menu items, and you can sit with the people that you came in with, not just some common table, family style, as we'd call it now.
So most of these restaurants are in New York.
Yeah. I'm embarrassed about that. That was really not my intention. And the ones that aren't in New York are mostly on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. So my excuse is that that's how innovation has traveled in the U.S. If I was going to do the history of American cuisine, it would not be at all New Yorker-centric. It wouldn't even be emphasis on the coasts, because the South, the Midwest, mm-hmm. New England, these are where American cuisine of the type that people cook at home developed.
That's a great answer to the question. Mm-hmm. We'll take a break at that point. 10 restaurants that changed America. It's new from Paul Friedman. Paul is our guest today on the KSRO Kitchen. I'm Steve Garner, along with Chef John Ash, back after this. In the KSRO Kitchen today, a pleasure to welcome Paul Friedman, last name spelled F-R-E-E-D-M-A-N. He's the author of a new book called 10 Restaurants That Changed America. Not the 10 best restaurants, but changed America. And why don't we jump in with the first one in the book, which was, as you said, the first real restaurant in American history.
Delmonico's, which was established in New York around 1830, was a French restaurant. And that's no accident, because France set the standard for the next 150 years and had before of what high-end food should be and what restaurants should be. In fact, Delmonico's was the most prestigious restaurant for all of the 19th century in the entire U.S., and lots of places opened up that imitated Delmonico's or called themselves Delmonico's. They apparently didn't have a trademark on the name.
You pointed out that
Emeril has a restaurant that goes back quite far, but it's called Delmonico's, and it's in New Orleans. That's exactly right. So Delmonico's actually offered a lot of American food or American specialties. Like, the most highly prized dishes of the time were oysters, terrapin, which is a kind of turtle, and canvasback ducks, so kind of wild duck, particularly associated with the Chesapeake Bay and the Gulf of Mexico. These were the grand dishes. They also invented some things like lobster Newburgh, baked Alaska. So their food was not slavishly French, but that was their model.
It was lobster Wennberg, wasn't it, originally?
Well, rumor has it that Ben Wennberg was a sailor who showed the owner of Delmonico how to make this very rich lobster dish with this kind of tomato-based sauce. And then he misbehaved in the restaurant, and they stripped the dish of his name and called it Newburgh. I'm not sure this is right, because if you look at the old menus, you never see lobster Wennberg, but there is terrapin Wennberg.
Mm. It's a wonderful story, and I want to believe it.
I do, too. Yeah. I totally agree.
You know, one of the little factoids about Delmonico's was that Napoleon dined there. Which is just amazing.
Napoleon III, I should say. Yes. So not the original Napoleon, but his grandson, who became emperor of France, spent some time in New York very early in the career of Delmonico's. I think maybe 1837 or something like that, and he enjoyed it.
So tell us about Lorenzo.
Lorenzo Delmonico presided over the restaurant during the height of its fame. And he was actually a rather abstemious, austere man, except that he smoked cigars all the time and probably died of nicotine poisoning. But he ran a very tight operation that was both traditional and expansive. They created new branches as the New York Theater District moved, but they also kept their original spot in what's now the financial district way, way downtown. He created new dishes. He hired one of the greatest chefs of the era, a man named Charles Ranhofer, who was French. But he also ran a place that was socially exclusive, but not so exclusive that you couldn't get in if you were, you know, as long as you were well-dressed and had the money to pay for an admittedly expensive meal. It was not all that snobbish, all that, you know, you've got to prove to us that you're cool.
Would they seat a single woman?
Well, no. That would be asking a little too much of the 19th century. They accommodated women, unaccompanied by men, so women in groups, but in private dining rooms. Only towards the end of the century do you see women just alone or women not escorted by men being served in the main dining rooms of Delmonico's.
I love the protocol they had there, that you'd get 14 courses and complete it in 2 hours.
2 hours, and Chef Ranhofer said, no problem. Imagine you have a better appreciation than I do, Chef, of what that takes in the way of particularly front-of-the-house service. You have to have a lot of waiters. Of course, he had lots of cooks. He had lots of staff.
It was an astounding menu, 40 veal dishes, 8 partridge dishes, 4 venison dishes, truffles galore, and vegetables that had never been really seen in the States.
This is what made me interested in this project in the first place. Just looking at what people ate in the 19th century puts to, if not to shame, at least in proportion, our boasts of living in the best food era in American history.
I like what Oscar Wilde wrote, that the two most important sites in America were Delmonico's and Yosemite Valley.
Now, how about that?
That's and high praise.
He was certainly serious about it.
And what's the next one in the book? Is it
Antoine's. Yeah.
So Antoine's was founded in 1840, not long after Delmonico's. And not only is it still around, but it's still run by the same family, the Alciatore family.
Is that a record? Are they the longest?
That is a record. That's by far a record.
It was French, or is French.
It was and is French in that it didn't really call itself a Creole restaurant until recently. Mm-hmm. The current owner, Rick Blount, now describes it as Haute Creole. And the menu has always been in French. In fact, it was only provided with an English translation beginning around 1990. The idea being that if customers didn't know what the dishes were, then they'd ask their waiter. They wanted people to get advice as to what to order if they didn't already know the menu. But their dishes were, they might have something called bouillabaisse, but it was a little more like gumbo. They had a lot of local fish that, of course, are unknown in France. So pompano is not a French fish, a Mediterranean or an Atlantic fish, and a style of preparation that is Creole. It incorporates French elements, very heavily influenced also by African American, Spanish, German kinds of sausages. It is a wonderful cuisine, and unlike that of really anywhere else.
Sorry, I have to ask a question. The difference between Creole and Cajun.
Yeah, well, Paul Prudhomme has a lot to be blamed for in the confusion between the two. Creole is the cuisine of New Orleans. It's an urban cuisine. It's closer to France. Cajun is the cuisine of the countryside. And these are people who actually settled Louisiana, not directly from France, but from Canada. The British engaged in a kind of ethnic cleansing when they conquered Canada, French Canada, in the mid-18th century. And these are Acadian exiles from the Acadian part of Canada. And that's why that's been abbreviated to or turned into the slang term Cajun. Their food has more game. It's more rustic. So crawfish in the Cajun cuisine, shrimp in the Creole cuisine. Alligator and all sorts of wild animals in Cajun cuisine, and basically butcher's meat, pork and beef from reputable sources in the Creole tradition.
Makes sense. The next chapter is Schraff's. That was one of my favorite chapters. You dined there with Grandma and Aunt?
I did. Schraff's was a small chain of restaurants on the East Coast. They featured ice cream, but also light food. They're in there because they were the first restaurant really to target women, and women not accompanied by men, but women who had been shopping or who worked in retail stores or as secretaries or clerical workers. And my grandmother liked to order what was considered a light main course, so like cottage cheese and fruit for her main course. And
is that where that came from? The cottage cheese fruit idea, but that's a Schraft's kind of.
I think Schraft's in that case doesn't innovate, but rather reflects.
Yeah.
So,
and what were you, a chicken a la King boy?
No, I think a club sandwich kind of guy. But the spectacle, I'm so glad my grandmother took me because my mother would never be seen there. My mother was a professional woman, and this was for women like my grandmother who liked to play canasta and mahjong to pass the time with her friends. So my grandmother would then follow up this light main course with a banana split or an ice cream sundae. And that was the notion of what women liked.
I love the comment that you made about Eleanor Roosevelt going to Schraft's to have them help her gussy up the White House menus.
The Roosevelt administration was great in many ways.
But food wasn't part of it.
Food is not part of it. No.
Let's just grab Howard Johnson's before we take a break, because I grew up with Howard Johnson. Did you eat at Howard Johnson's?
Of course. Not out here, not on the West Coast. But I would go every summer to New York. And, of course, getting the Ipswich clams was that was the treat.
When we were growing up, I think all three of us, the 40s, 50s, and 60s, it was a landmark along the highways.
Mm-hmm. It was a quality landmark, too. There were plenty of places to eat along the highways, but most of them were kind of truck stops or what used to be called greasy spoons.
Well, you said that in the 70s, I wrote this down, 929 restaurants and 526 motor hotels or motor lodges.
It was huge. And it served more people than any other institution except the Army at that time.
It was astounding. Both Jacques Pepin and Pierre Frenet helped to make this menu really stellar in the late 50s, early 60s.
Certainly as good as you could get with a company that was servicing so many different branches. Jacques Pepin and Pierre Frenet insisted that they use butter rather than margarine. Things like those clams. Imagine trying to get the United States outside of Cape Cod to eat fried clams. Now it seems so logical, but that really took some not only imagination but education of your customers.
And they show up again, Franny and Pepin, later in the book, too.
We'll stop at that point. Paul Friedman is our guest in the KSRO Kitchen today. New book is 10 Restaurants That Changed America. It's getting a lot of play and well-deserved also. I'm Steve Garner along with Chef John Ash. This is KSRO. Working our way through the top 10 restaurants that changed America.
Can I, just a really final little question about Howard Johnson's. So what did them in?
What did them in one respect is just fast food. Mm. Fast food was a better business model. You have almost no labor cost. Your investment is really in a technology. You're only producing one or two kinds of items instead of having a menu with hundreds of items. They also had some mismanagement. They simply got tired. They engaged in too much cost cutting and then couldn't really rescue the quality and reputation of the brand. Their franchises were spun off and had trouble holding each other together or functioning as a unity. There is now exactly one Howard Johnson's, and it's in Lake George, New York. And the management of that restaurant claims they're going strong, and they have no intention of closing.
Do you know what? That's where I used to go, because I spent my summers up on Lake George.
Amazing. Amazing.
So, Paul, what was the restaurant that pioneered Italian restaurants for non-Italians? It's in your book.
It's Mama Leone's in New York, and I guess I've gotten a certain amount of pushback on this because people say, oh, so schlocky, it was so touristy. How could you have as your model of an Italian restaurant with so many wonderful ones? Again, the point is not wonderful food. It is influential food. And until recently, Italian food was a kind of spectacle. It was not particularly authentic, but that's what it was, as an adaptation of Italian food to American tastes, and Americans expected a lot of spectacle, big quantity, huge pasta dishes, and flirtatious or at least charming waiters, a certain image of Italy that it's probably tough being an Italian to live down, but there it is.
I ate there back in the 60s with my mom and dad, and I just thought it was the greatest food I ever had.
Well, you traced also how Italian food and how ethnic food in general has worked in America. It starts off by being very bohemian. It's you know, cool people go there first, and then the masses come, and then it changes.
It's like a lot of things, like tech. So there are early adapters. There are people who used mm-hmm. computers in the late 70s and early 80s. The mass of people didn't come in until later in the 80s. So the same is true with Chinese, Italian, Thai, all so-called ethnic restaurants.
But it's there. You also make comment at the end of that little chapter about there's a real renaissance of red sauce Italian restaurants mm-hmm. happening again. I mean,
so much so that since I wrote the chapter, now the people who run Nomad, which is the same people who run 11 Madison Park in New York, the highly, highly rated restaurants, have a kind of quasi pop-up that is in direct imitation of Mama Leone's. Mm. And, you know, it's mobbed. It's a very hard reservation.
Well, then you mentioned somebody who we've had on the show, the guys from Frankie's Spuntino.
Right.
Which was...
And they're pioneers in that. Yeah. Absolutely. That's now 7-8 years old.
From Mama Leone's in New York, we go out to the West Coast to the Mandarin. And, John, you ate at the Mandarin years ago.
Yeah, so many times. Actually.
So why was that so instrumental that it made it in your top 10?
Well, it was among the first places to get out of the Cantonese or more or less Cantonese pattern. It was the first place I ever had potstickers, hot and sour soup, Peking duck. It also was quite high-end. It was elegant. And that has not always been something that Chinese restaurants could maintain. There's a lot of price resistance among non-Chinese customers. It is also a restaurant with a fascinating story. Its owner is Cecilia Chang, and I was going to say was because the restaurant no longer exists, but Cecilia Chang at 97 years old is going strong.
You end up by saying that she kind of almost single-handedly changed the appreciation of Chinese food in America.
A lot of the development of different regional foods, mm-hmm. Sichuan was very big in the 70s, for example, Hunan after that. Shanghai, Beijing, is due to the influence of the
Mandarin. Okay, so what's the connection to Panda Express?
The founder of Panda Express was a cook at Cecilia Chang's restaurant in Tokyo in the 1950s. Cecilia Chang has had an extraordinary life, having to flee the Japanese when they invaded northern China in the, they invaded in the late 30s, but her family fled around 1940, 41, and then fleeing the communist takeover in 1949 from Shanghai, she went with her husband to Tokyo and created her first restaurant, a place called Forbidden City in Tokyo, and the founder of Panda Express was one of her chefs.
Amazing. As we go back to the East Coast, we hit Sylvia's, the soul of Harlem.
Sylvia's is still around and flourishing. It is a example not only of African-American or soul cuisine, a cuisine sometimes called Southern, sometimes called down home, but it is also an example of the migration of black people from the South to the North, because essentially it is in Harlem. It is associated with a lot of politicians, entertainment figures, people in the church. It's really an anchor for the Harlem community, but the food is Southern.
I like it a lot. I ate there, and of course, she cooks vegetables the way I like to cook them, because I grew up in the South, and that you boil them to death.
Collard greens, I just had them last week, are unbelievable, and I lived in the South for a long time. I taught at Vanderbilt, so I know collard greens.
Talk about Le Pavillon.
Le Pavillon was named because it had been the restaurant of the French Pavilion at the 3940 World's Fair. Mm-hmm. And the staff were refugees because the Nazis conquered France, and they created a restaurant in New York in the seemingly inauspicious year 1941 mm-hmm. called Le Pavillon. It was run by the dictatorial genius monster Henri Soule, and Henri Soule created the perfect French restaurant in the U.S., and it was the most prestigious restaurant from its foundation until Soule's sudden death in 1965.
Were you able to dine there as a young man?
No, I wasn't. To my regret, it was probably too snobbish for my parents, too expensive. Henri Soule has a lot to answer for. A lot of our image of French restaurants as snobbish, as standoffish, as elitist is not really French, but it really is owed to the pavillon and to the restaurants that it generated. It created a lot of imitators, and a lot of its veterans either fled Henri Soulet and created their own restaurants. And so some of our image of French restaurants, which I don't think is justified, is based on
that. And this is where Franny and Jacques Pepin were. They got into a dispute with him and left, and I guess went to Howard Johnson.
Yes, unlike many of these other people who worked there and then got into disputes with Henri Soulet, those other people founded French restaurants. Franny and Pepin went to Howard Johnson's and loved it.
Let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll tackle the final two restaurants in the 10 restaurants that changed America. Paul Friedman is the author of this terrific new book, John Ash and Steve Garner in the KSRO Kitchen. Well, we have gone through 8 of the 10 restaurants that changed America. Paul Friedman, I can hear many people yelling and screaming out there. How could he have, or why didn't
why
he
did
include?
He forget but, Chicago?
But remember, it's his book.
Yeah,
he can do what he wants. The 9th restaurant in the book, Paul, also in New York, the Four Seasons. Did you ever have a chance to dine there, John?
I did. And when I dined at the Four Seasons, actually a couple of times, it was a little shabby then. It went through, I mean, it was this architectural marvel. It was, would you call it the most modernist?
You called it the epitome of modern.
Yeah. It's a perfect example of mid-century modern. It's 1959 it was founded. It cost the equivalent of $34 billion. To design, cost mostly borne by the Seagram Company in the Seagram building, and it was nothing was bought off the shelf, from the glasses to the chairs. Part of its difficulty of maintenance is that everything is one of a kind, and so the interior is landmarked. It can't be changed. It's very beautiful, but it dates from 1959, so it's kind of hard to keep it up.
This is where madmen would take potential high-spending clients during the series.
Yes, there are several restaurants in Mad Men. I think they have the Forbes and the 12 Caesars, the La Fonda del Sol. These are places that were created by a company called Restaurant Associates, and Four Seasons is the highest end of them and the most tasteful.
But then it came back later in its life. I mean, it kind of, different ownership, different management sort of changed its focus.
It's been flourishing really since the late 1970s. Some of that is the diffusion of the notion of seasonal food. Some of it is it became, to use an overworked term, an icon. And some of it is that it developed what came to be called the power lunch, a term first applied to the Four Seasons and the scene there. And a power lunch is not just a socially elite lunch, which goes back, Delmonico's had socially elite lunches. It's not just socially elite, it's a place where deals are made. And so the power part is not just, oh, these are important people or wealthy people. It's these are important people who are actually negotiating real estate deals, or back in the 70s and 80s, book contracts or wine distribution agreements.
I learned in this chapter about a man named Joe Baum, who you wrote that it was amazing how this man's singular vision could influence an entire generation. What was it about him?
He is one of these people who has lots of ideas, tremendous energy, and a willingness to spend money, not a great deal of follow through. So he would go on to new projects after the Four Seasons, but he was given a free rein in the late 50s and early 60s to create all sorts of incredible restaurants, and the scenes in Mad Men, or that image of a combination of modernity, swankness, a refinement, but also a certain spectacular vulgarity. That is Joe Baum.
Also, this restaurant won a prestigious James Beard Award in 1999 for Best American Food, Best Cuisine.
It was a wonderful restaurant. It has just closed.
And then the final restaurant in the top 10 is, back to the West Coast we go.
Yeah, to Chez Panisse. Huh.
Of all the restaurants in my list, this is the one that has no pushback. Nobody has said, oh, what's Chez Panisse doing there? You can't imagine modern American food, seasonal, local, without Chez Panisse.
And you subtitle that The Way We Eat Now.
That's
so
right.
So that encompasses everything that's happened basically in the past 35 years or so in America.
If not everything, certainly everything in the high end and not even very high end, and also in, outside of the sort of ethnic food realm, so that it's not just in the Bay Area now that you get seasonal and local or on the East Coast, but in Nashville, Tennessee, which I am familiar with, Columbus, Ohio, which I visited recently, really everywhere there's a ambitious food scene. They are rediscovering or reviving local ingredients. They're concerned with the quality of the ingredients, not just mixing them up in some way that is distracting. That is all really, Alice Waters wasn't the only person, but she's the trailblazer.
But you, not but, in the book, though, you talk about some of the controversy around Alice. I mean, Julia Child had some differences with Alice, and others have, too, including Jeremiah Tower, who I remember when we had his book, California Dish, when we had him on the show, he made this comment. I don't know whether you'll agree, but he said, Alice Waters wouldn't know the difference between a green bean and an asparagus. You know,
that's one Jeremiah Tower. There's a Jeremiah Tower that also grudgingly admits that he may have inspired her, but she had the follow-through, mm-hmm. and that... An important point he made to me in talking to me was that she was doing, is doing now, the same thing she wanted to do 40 years ago. It's not French, maybe. It's more local. But a certain kind of restaurant, there's only one Chez Panisse. She hasn't made it a franchise. She hasn't maximized her reputation in order to make money or have a product line. And, of course, she's very involved in trying to make food a thing to rally around to improve society generally. And so even Jeremiah Tower admits that. Mm-hmm. Whether Alice Waters is a chef or a sort of a composer of food or an inspirer of food, I would say, as we used to say in Nashville, I don't have a dog in that particular fight.
But she's a visionary.
She is. Yeah. She remains a visionary.
And that's the top 10. And I was just as intrigued by the epilogue. That what you wrote is in the epilogue, the end of the French rule. And then the five trends. Could you go over the five trends that you see happening?
Yes, I can remember all of them.
That's right. I'll
have here, you I'm going to pass it
can,
to you.
If you can prompt me. So, yes, the trends are, first of all, farm to table. And that is the dominant restaurant trend today and encompasses what would be seasonal and local. Mm-hmm. Then the, in a way, opposite of that is the movement that hasn't gotten a lot of purchase mm-hmm. in the United States, but is internationally very popular. Yes. That's what's sometimes called molecular or modernist food. And that is more artificial, more inspired, more wild. I think that Americans are still rediscovering actual farms, and we already know about wild and strange food. If you want wild and strange food, Pringles or 1,000 items in your supermarket will really fulfill that. So we don't really need molecular gastronomy, perhaps. A third trend is the celebrity chefs. And it's not that celebrity chefs are new, but chefs as artists, as opposed to great craftsmen, that's relatively new. So back to the Middle Ages, there's a chef named Taillevant in the 14th century who cooked for the kings of France, and he was knighted, and his tomb shows him with a sword and his coat of arms. His coat of arms are three little stew pots, it's true, but he was able to do things better than other people. Going back to the tortellini, it's within a model, within a pattern. It's not that he created the way Ferran Adrià of El Bulli or René Redzepi of Noma create dishes that no one has ever seen before, or things with liquid nitrogen or alginate or foam that nobody has ever even thought of before. My fourth trend, or the fourth that I identify, is basically the influence of Asia.
Absolutely.
And this is not only the popularity of Asian restaurants, Japanese, Thai, but Asian fusion, as it's sometimes called, the introduction of Asian ingredients like soy sauce or lemongrass into a cuisine that's not exactly Asian.
And certainly Korean restaurants, the explosion of Korean in this country.
Yes.
It's astounding.
Yes.
And next is...
And then finally, the new informality. Informality meaning decor, appeal to a younger demographic, no more carpeting, tuxedoed waiters, leather-covered huge menus. This doesn't mean the end of snobbery. So a lot of restaurants are hard to get into, hard to figure out where they are. Some of them are like almost speakeasies. Many of them you can't get a reservation unless you have some secret phone number or computer site. And people are as snobbish as ever. I try to emphasize it's just that they don't value the same kind of look. But a hip restaurant or a chic restaurant of the 1950s have more similarities than differences, in my opinion.
And then the appendix, the classic recipes for the 10 restaurants in the book, including the Chicken a la King. And thank you for including that from...
Seemed that you had to have something like that.
And I guess I have to ask this question. You've probably been asked it a lot on your interview tour, but what was the 11th restaurant that didn't make it into the book?
I'd say either French Laundry or Alinea. Alinea in Chicago, because it is the most successful and accomplished example of molecular gastronomy in America. French Laundry, because it combines the farm-to-table ethos of Alice Waters with a kind of innovation that is associated with molecular gastronomy.
Is there going to be another 10 book in you?
I'm not sure. Let's see what happens with this before deciding.
Well, it's an extraordinary work. Would you give us your favorite number today between 1 and 15?
7.
Oh, caller number 7 at 636-1350 will win this autographed copy of 10 Restaurants That Changed America by our guest, Paul Friedman. Thank you for writing this. Wasn't it fun?
It really was a lot of fun for me. Thanks for having me on the show.
Great. I'm Steve Garner for Chef John Ash. Talk to you next week from the KS Arto Kitchen.